welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. As I record this, it is Monday, May 14th, 2012. I'm Sam Minter, no Yvonne Bo with me today. We normally record our show on Sunday, of course. Yvonne let me know on Saturday that he couldn't make it due to a death in the family. So our condolences to Yvonne. It was an uncle, I believe. On goes the show. I did ask a couple people to co-host. Neither one of them got back to me in time with an affirmative. So here I am, another solo show and another solo show in the car, because, of course, that's how it always ends up being the most convenient time to do a solo show. I guess I could do it just at the same time we normally record the show, but what always invariably happens is other things fill up that time because, you know, I don't have the discipline of having Yvonne right there to do it. Anyway, a number of things have happened in the news this week, but, you know, a lot of them are follow-up to our conversation last week. We talked about Joe Biden's comments on gay marriage and the position Obama was in terms of having this stupid, stupid position that he was evolving on the issue. And basically after the Biden comments, that position became untenable. Everybody was asking about it. Everybody was saying, well, you know, has the position changed? Are you moving forward? What's going on? What's with this whole evolving thing? What are you evolving to? Hey, by the way, did you notice that, like, a number of years ago there are interviews with you saying that you're supporting gay marriage, so did you evolve away from it and now you're evolving back towards it? What's going on here? And so the Obama administration did pretty much what it had to do at that point, which was come out and actually say what they obviously believed all along, which is gay marriage is a good thing and should be policy. Now, there are a couple of details on that that are important. Obama hasn't actually gone so far as to say it's a basic civil right that should be applied, you know, universally. Certainly not across the whole world, not even across the whole United States. He took a very federalist stand, saying this is a state issue, and that states should be able to define marriage however they want. And of course that would mean that because of reciprocity conditions and such, if one state determined it was legal, you could go get married there, then move to a state where it wasn't legal and still have that marriage recognized, things like that. But he did not come out in favor of, say, a federal law supporting gay marriage and overriding the states, which presumably also means that things like the IRS still wouldn't recognize it. Well, I guess maybe they would recognize it if the states recognized it. I don't know, if you had a marriage that was legal in a state. Anyway, something like that. So it's not a full-out, you know, as far as the activists on the issue would like. From my personal position, I'm all for states having a lot of leeway to do what they want individually and for the federal government generally not to get involved. So I don't mind this position that much. Well, I don't mind this position, period. Forget that much. I don't mind this position. I think a federalist position is a reasonable position to be at. Now, so this, of course, has potential consequences, because the reason, of course, that Obama was equivocating in the way he was is because we are not yet at a point where the entire population of the country is overwhelmingly in favor of this. And Obama tends to, in many cases, not all cases, but, you know, part of his style is this whole lead from behind thing. He wants the sort of, maybe influence the, I don't know, like, basically, wait until the situation is right, where the support is already there on an issue to really push it. And we talked about this last week a little bit too, in terms of picking battles, and only picking battles you can win. So the idea was here that gay marriage wasn't quite there yet. There wasn't yet strong enough support nationally and distributed across the states for it to be a winning position for Obama to come out in favor of it. So he sort of was trying to keep quiet, not make too many waves, say he was evolving, you know, say, yeah, it's a man and a woman, blah, 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 but I'm evolving. What this means is, of course, he is now taking a position that is not, at best, nationally, it's a 50-50 issue. And I think some polls show that it's actually not quite that. And so that if you, you know, there's certainly parts of the country, the very blue states tend to be already there and fairly for this, although only a few have actually passed laws. And in every, you know, let me get ahead of myself. There are states where this is clearly a winner. There are states where this is clearly a loser. And, of course, there are all the purple states in between. But they don't necessarily correspond to the swing states as Democratic, Republican, as the polls were taking beforehand. It's unclear how that goes. I've seen a number of analysis and preliminary looks at polling on the issue. I don't think much has been done since this announcement yet. But their polling on the issue in general sort of shows that this will basically, on the whole, it's going to hurt Obama. Because while there are, you know, more Republicans are willing... What's the right way to say this? I've looked at a number of different analyses. They all look at this in different ways. The one thing they tend to agree on is that the people who care deeply about this on the anti side are more likely to change their vote because of it. And, of course, that only really matters for the people who are in the middle and are sort of wishy-washy and the traditional swing voters, the undecideds, the people who are wholehearted Republican, very few of them are going to change their vote to Democrat because of this. Like, you know, if they're not, you know, the percentage of Republicans that are for gay marriage is small to begin with. But even of those, not many of them are going to change based on this single issue. For instance, Meghan McCain, John McCain's daughter, very prominently in favor of gay marriage, but still a Republican, not likely to vote for Obama. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, you have some Democrats who are also against gay marriage. Some of them, maybe this would be enough to make them flip to McCain. But again, we're talking about those undecided folks in the middle. The die-hard partisans aren't going to change because of anything like this. And so, how does that split? Well, that's the tricky part. And, of course, this is a presidential election. So, again, just like with everything I've talked about in the national election, it is deceptive to look at national polls on this issue. You really have to look at state-by-state polls because, you know, how does this affect the polling in New York? Doesn't matter. The Democrats win New York. Same with California. And it, you know, on the flip side, the Republicans are going to win Mississippi. This issue doesn't matter. Whether it makes the Republicans a little bit stronger or a little bit weaker on the margins, doesn't matter. Now, where does it get tricky? Let's look at North Carolina. North Carolina just passed by a fairly large margin a law, you know, outlawing gay marriage in North Carolina. I believe it actually a constitutional amendment to the North Carolina Constitution saying this. This has been, up till now, a swing state where it's been too close to call. At various points, it's been slightly Romney or slightly Obama, but bottom line, it's too close to call. North Carolina has been too close to call. Is this something that will push it definitively into the Romney side? Maybe. Maybe. And that's the kind of thing you want to look at, is at these specific states that have been straddling the line, are there some of those states where the gay marriage issue is going to be critical because it flips people to one side of that line or another. Or does this end up being a non-issue? I don't think it's going to be a non-issue. There are people, I've heard a number of people that said, this will all come out in the wash. By the time we get to November, no one will even care about this. You know, it's the economy, stupid. The social issues are going to have effects on the margins, blah, blah, blah. You know, and maybe. Yeah, I don't deny that the economy is probably a bigger effect. This might be a second-order effect. But if it's close, second-order effects matter a lot. Someone else made the comment, and I can't remember who, that in a close election, every special interest claims it's their issue that made a difference. Now, I believe this comment was made derisively, as in, yeah, it's not you that made the difference, it's not you that's made a difference, it's not you that made a difference. You know, actually, if it's a close election, they're all right. Every single one of those issues. If it's a close election, everything makes a difference. That's the nature of a close election, is that any one of dozens of factors, if they'd gone slightly differently, the result would have gone differently. That's what happens in a close election. That's what makes it close. So yeah, you have to watch all of these different things. We have to see how it plays out. I mean, it's been mentioned another possibility is, you know, if Obama gets in front of, on this issue, maybe he can actually help change people's minds. So rather than people changing who they vote for based on Obama's stance on this issue, Obama's stance on this issue changes people's ideas on this issue, which in turn would have electoral results, basically making this, neutralizing this somewhat, and maybe pushing it a little in Obama's direction. I frankly don't see Obama doing that unless he's forced into it. He was obviously reluctant to get out in front on this issue. I think he's still going to be reluctant. I think he made this move because he was forced to, and, you know, that'll bring up some comments about Biden again. But I don't think he's going to go any further ahead than he feels like he's forced to. Now, if Romney decides to make this an issue that he's going to fight on and starts, you know, basically gay baiting this thing and saying, how can you possibly vote for Obama? He's for gay marriage, as like a defining issue of the campaign. Then Obama's going to need to respond more cleanly to that. He's going to need to clarify his position further. He's going to have to defend his position. He's going to have to talk about it a lot more. And if that happens, maybe he'll push further ahead, and maybe he'll go into the mode of, you know, trying to convert people. I don't know. It does add an interesting dynamic to the equation. Like, when all this contraception stuff came up in the Republican primaries, everybody was talking about how social issues were a loser for the Republicans. And the fact that they were forced to talk about these social issues by some of Santorum's comments was hurting them for the general election. And they needed to get away from these social issues as quickly as possible and get back to the economy, the economy, the economy. And I think that was true in terms of the contraception debate. It's a closer call on gay marriage. At least according to the polling I've read. So again, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Let's go ahead and take a break. There's more on game, gay-related issues yet to talk about, because there was also a story that came out this week about Romney doing some bullying against a presumably homosexual person when he was in high school, which was a long time ago. We'll talk more about that and some of the details and, you know, whether that should matter after the break. And we'll also talk about, you know, the Biden comments have at least some people calling once again for Obama to dump Biden from the campaign. And, yeah, we'll talk about that too. And then, who knows, there's stuff going on in Greece. There's other things going on. We're just winging it this week. We'll see what happens. We're taking this break. And, you know, I'm driving to work right now on Monday. And by the time I continue recording, it probably won't be Monday anymore UTC. At the very least, I'll be coming home from work. It may even be the next time I'm going to work. Who knows? Anyway, enjoy this break. And we'll be back after this. And we're back. And it is now Tuesday, May 15th. UTC, of course. I use UTC even though I'm on the west coast of the U.S. This means that I'm actually, according to the folks around here, leaving work on Monday afternoon, or Monday evening. It's a little before 6 o'clock local time here. But it's just after, it's 042 UTC. So it's Tuesday the 15th, damn it. Anyway, I said the next thing we were going to talk about is sort of the revelations about some things Romney did at high school. And I'll add to that, there's also been some stuff in the news about, you know, Obama's ex-girlfriend from college and some things she had to say about him in a recent book and blah, blah, blah. And I want to put this all together in terms of how much should we care about the ancient history of candidates? You know, this was many years ago at this point. There's lots of history since then. I think we spoke last year when we were talking about the faked resume. Surely what matters is what the people have been doing the last few years. Really, you know, if they've got a long, distinguished career, you look at the whole career, but the most important is what have you been doing lately? So how much does it really matter what they did in high school or college? Because, you know, hopefully, most people, you know, mature a lot and learn a lot and are a very different person at age 50 or 60, or for that matter, 40 or even 30, than they were, you know, when they were in high school or even college. A lot happens in those years that significantly change people and make them into, you know, hopefully better people. But, oh, look, a police car went by. That's why I was, you know, quiet for a second, because I had to, like, scooch over to the side and let them pass. I even forgot you were there for a second. Anyway, the point of all this is, let's see what happened. In Obama's case, there really wasn't anything devastating. The college girlfriend said, you know, a few potentially personal, somewhat embarrassing, maybe, things, but nothing that, at least to me, seemed downright horrible. There's certainly more in Obama's book, you know. The whole thing about him eating dog meat when he was a kid came from his book. It's not like this was secret. He talked in his book about using drugs. He talked in his book about various other things that were, you know, as they say, youthful indiscretions. And that was well vetted, you know, even before the last election. Yeah, now people will say, maybe it wasn't vetted enough, and they'll bring it up again. But my God, if it's something the guy wrote in his own best-selling book, you know, it's not like it's a secret. So I'm not sure how much that is worth. But who knows? There may be another Obama revelation coming next week. You know, you never know the things people have in their closets. Romney's, I think, is a little bit different. And I don't know. By the time we get to the election, it'll all have blown over and blah, blah, blah. This is probably a dust-up that'll last a week. But I'm not sure that it should only last a week, to be honest. And so, for those of you who haven't heard, the story is basically this. You know, the people involved who came out with this story basically, you know, said, look, you know, at the time, we didn't talk about people being gay or whatever. That wasn't part of the consciousness so much. But we did talk about people being sort of sissies. And they were ostracized and picked on and blah, blah, blah. And those kinds of things happen. And it's a high school, for God's sake. Anybody here who's been to high school knows that it can be pretty vicious. You know, there are cliques and there are people that, you know, if you're not in the right group, people make fun of you. The cliques have, whatever, you know. That kind of thing does happen. But, so what happened here is this guy had longish hair. He had it dyed blonde, I guess. Basically, you know, in a way that stood out from what was the normal sort of conservative style at this prep school. And Romney and company and his friends were sort of making fun of this guy and teasing him for it and blah, 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 telling him he should cut his hair. And then one time it went further than that. Romney and a bunch of his friends, you know, caught the guy and held him down physically and cut his hair. And sort of forced him down, cut his hair. The guy was sort of kicking and screaming and pleading for mercy and for them not to do it, blah, 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 whatever. Now, they didn't physically beat him up or anything, but they assaulted him and chopped off his hair. At least some of it. Who knows how much? Several of the participants have said, you know, over the last couple weeks, that over the years they came to really regret that. They apologized to the guy. They felt horrible about it ever since, etc. The actual guy in question died from cancer a while back. I forget how many years, but a while back. Romney, when the story came out about this in the Washington Post, said, you know, he didn't recall the incident, but if he ever did anything, but he wasn't going to argue with the people who are saying that it happened. And if he did anything that offended anybody or anything like that, he apologized. And so, let's split this into two bits here. One is, of course, people do stupid things. People do even stupider things often when they're young, in high school and college and whatever. I'm not so sure in high school, but I can tell you personally myself in, you know, sort of college and the couple years after, maybe, you know, from, let's just say my 20s. There were a few things I did that I regret. That I am, like, in retrospect, I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking? You know, I was doing things that were stupid. I was doing things that, that I regret now. I mean, nothing, you know, major. I didn't assault anybody, I don't think. You know, I didn't do anything that should have got me thrown in jail, I don't think. You know, but, you know, there are definitely things that, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, oh my God, how could I possibly have done that? I was such an idiot. There are so many better things I could have done. I was doing something that, you know, maybe it was hurtful. Maybe it was just stupid. Maybe it was dangerous. Whatever. But, you know, those kinds of things happen. And, you know, maybe I was a little bit late doing those kinds of things in my 20s, where most people do them in their teens and maybe early 20s. I don't know. But, you know, the point is the same. When people are young, they do some crazy things. They do some things without fully thinking them through. They're impulsive, whatever. And so maybe this was it, you know? You know, he wanted to be cool, and the cool thing to do was to make fun of this kid, because that got him in with the, you know, the people around him, whatever. And if indeed, you know, he learned from that experience and matured and sort of was sorry for it, and, you know, all of this kind of thing, then okay. I'm willing to give people a pass that do stupid, crazy, impulsive, bad things if they truly learn from them and improve and, you know, and part, and I guess, I was going to say own up for it, but I don't know that that's, like, you know, I mentioned I did stupid things. I'm not going to list them for you. You know, I would probably prefer some of them never become public, you know, but if confronted with them, yeah, I'd like to think that I would do the right thing, but I definitely think that I've learned from them and moved forward. And, but what gets me about Romney's reaction here is not that, is that he didn't say any of that stuff. He didn't say, I mean, he did say, I did a lot of stupid things when I was young, but he didn't say, yes, I did this, yes, it was stupid, I am sorry, it was a horrible thing, you know, I learned. He said he didn't remember the incident. He didn't remember the incident. Now, there are two possible answers to this. One is that he damn well does remember the time he grabbed someone, held them down, forced them into something, kicking and screaming against their will, and is lying about it. That's one answer, and that's pretty bad. The second answer is he really doesn't remember it, in which case, really? Did you do this so often that this case doesn't stand out? That's a pretty bad answer, too. Or, you know, and, you know, if he wasn't Mormon, I'd be like, or were you, like, too drunk or high to remember it? And who knows, maybe. But, like, there, if he really doesn't remember it, something's going on. He either did this a lot, or there's some chemical thing comes up. I mean, I have a bad memory. I have a hard time remembering things that happened last week, let alone things that happened while I was in college. But there are certain types of events that kind of should stand out and that are memorable. And honestly, I don't believe for one second that Romney really doesn't remember this. I'd be scared if he didn't remember it, but I don't believe he doesn't remember it. I believe he remembers it. Come on. He's out and out lying here. And it's the wrong answer. Like, the right answer here is yes. Yes, I did that. And I am ashamed of what I did as a young man. And I know better now, and I'm a much better person now than I was then. That's the right answer. Not, oh, I don't remember, and I'm ashamed, I apologize for anybody that may have taken offense for any of my pranks. Physically assaulting somebody is not a prank. It's a crime. You know, and I understand, you know, okay, fine, you know, high school hijinks, blah, blah, blah. Yes, high school hijinks. That doesn't excuse a damn thing. It's not a boys will be boys kind of crap. It's being civil to your fellow human being. And if you're not capable in high school of doing that, I mean, yes, people mature, but, like, there are plenty of people in high school who don't go around taking the nerdy kid and shoving their head in the toilet, or cutting their hair, or whatever. And, you know, honestly, I'm lucky. That didn't really happen to me as far as I can remember. I had some verbal taunting. I was the nerdy kid. Big surprise, everybody. I'm sure no one is surprised there. Some of the people listening went to high school with me. You probably remember. But, you know, there was some taunting and stuff, but I never got, like, physically assaulted. I'm sorry. It's just, can't you freaking own up to it? Is it that much to ask? Apparently it is. Apparently it is. You know, and like I said, I don't think this will get any traction. It'll disappear from the news stories. You're not gonna hear Obama at the debates asking about, well, what about the time you cut that kid's hair? You know, but I think it does paint a picture of Mitt. And again, like, I'm willing to dismiss the stuff that happened in high school decades ago, but his reaction now sucks. You know, and he's not denying it, but he's not really taking responsibility either. And I think that shows a very good insight into his character. And I don't know. I guess that's about all there is to say for now. We'll wait to hear what else we hear about the youthful endeavors of Mitt and Barack. I'm sure they have both done additional things that will be brought up over the campaign, because campaigns are like that, and they get dirty, and yeah. Anyway, let's take another break. We'll be back, and we'll talk about some other stuff. Probably not even related to the presidential election. Maybe. Eh. Or maybe I'll throw some presidential election stuff in there just to, you know, keep it going. Anyway, but probably something else. Back after this. Enjoy the message. And for me, it'll probably be hours later again. Like when I'm going to work tomorrow. Because I have a feeling, knowing what I have to go into work for tomorrow morning, and more specifically, when, I may have a little bit to rant about in the morning. Anyway, back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready, Frankenstein. Then, let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
And welcome back. So, I said I'd probably, you know, do this in the morning on the way back to work, and indeed it is in the morning on the way back to work. It is only about 12 hours after the last bit of this recording, and I mentioned I might have something to rant about, and I'll rant about it just for a couple minutes, because it's really irrelevant to all of you guys. But it's 12:39 UTC, which means here on the west coast of the United States, it is 5:37 in the morning, and I am driving to work. I left the house about 10 minutes ago. And I think I've said this before, I'm not a morning person. You know, if I had my say, my workday would start after noon. and go till like 8 p.m. or something. But it would, like, the morning would not exist for me. But, you know, there are a few factors that are now in play. One is, of course, I have a kid now. Well, I mean, I've had a kid for a while. I've had Amy. And even with her, it started. Because there's the whole getting to school thing. You know, and guess what? Most schools start at like 8 o'clock in the morning or something. Now, the last couple years, Amy's had a weird schedule, so it's been all over the place. But, yeah, there were a number of years I got that. And I had a job for a while on the West Coast that had an 8 a.m. West Coast. On the East Coast, when I lived in Florida, that had an 8 a.m. meeting every freaking day. Yeah, that was murder on me. But now, the position I'm in now, we have 8 a.m. meetings twice a week to have conference calls with folks in Europe. And video conferences, actually, usually. And, you know, that's already pretty rough. Especially because, you know, the schedule's not... Because it's only twice a week, and then the rest of the week there's later starts, you don't get a pattern going of, like... You don't get into a routine, at least I don't, because I don't force myself to keep that schedule the rest of the week. And today... I've got a 7 a.m. I'm doing some stuff. It's whatever reason. It's scheduled at 7 a.m. And it just kills me. It just kills me. I went to bed around midnight. Alarm started going off at around 4. I was actually, you know, out of bed and starting to begin my day and get ready at 4:45. Ridiculous. That kind of stuff shouldn't happen. Now, I know people have jobs at all kinds of hours, and lots of people have to get up earlier than that, and good for you. I'm just saying I hate it. I absolutely hate it. Like, this is the kind of thing that if it was all the time, you know, would have me looking for another job. I mean, I like my job. I like what I'm doing. Oh, but I can't stand the mornings. I can't stand the mornings. Now, every once in a while is fine. I mean, I do one of these 7 a.m. things maybe once every 6 months. I do the 8 a.m. twice a week. And the rest of the time, the schedule is very flexible, you know, and depending on the day, you know, I usually try to get in around 10. Sometimes it's 11. But, you know, and I make up for it by the various other times, and it all averages out, but, what a pain. Anyway, I must say, though, the traffic's better at 5:30 in the morning than it is at 7 in the morning. A little bit. Anyway, moving on. There is one more presidential thing. I know. I said I'd probably move on, but I might throw something, and I'll throw something in. There's an announcement that Ron Paul's campaign made yesterday that he's no longer going to be actively campaigning in the remainder of the primary states. He has no hope of winning them. It'd be a waste of money, etc. The way this was reported in many ways was... Ron Paul suspending his campaign, blah, blah, blah. I did not put a Paul out post on my blog like I have with Santorum and Gingrich and some of the others way earlier. And that's because it was actually a little bit more ambiguous. He didn't just come right out and say, I'm suspending my campaign. He said he's not going to actively campaign in these primary states. But he is going to continue his delegate collection strategy. And so that's basically working the party processes that to collect delegates and to start win these local party offices that will make you that help give control of the party in future election cycles. Which, again, everybody sort of thinks he's setting things up for Rand Paul in 2016. But there are reports that he was sort of frustrated by the fact that in a number of states where these processes have been going on in the last few weeks...
This is Future Sam. At that point, I accidentally stopped recording. Then, a few minutes later, I started recording again, but this time, walking instead of being in the car. This was a mistake. This was a big mistake. As you listen to the next segment, you'll notice it is very, very noisy. All kinds of pops, all kinds of whistles, and not to mention, as I walked, I started getting out of breath. Anyway, please forgive us. Please forgive me. This next segment is kind of hard to listen to. I did my best to minimize those effects, but it still sucks. Sorry. Here it goes.
Reminder to self. When recording podcasts in the car, or just in general, using the note recorder on my iPhone, if the alarm goes off, it stops the recording. So, after the little bit you just heard, I continued talking happily to myself in my car, thinking I was recording the podcast for about another 15 minutes, talking about mostly presidential election stuff. And then I pulled into my parking space at work, I closed up, and I realized it wasn't recording. And it had stopped exactly when one of my alarms went off for the normal time I'd be waking up that I was already on the road. Anyway, I am now in the process of walking from where I parked my car to where my first meeting is, which is in another building, so I've got like a 15-minute walk. So I'm recording again. People walking down the street will see me gesticulating and talking on my phone, and little will they know that I'm not actually talking to somebody, but I'm recording a show. In any case, to continue on a little bit from what I was saying, and, you know, of course I won't reproduce what you missed, sorry guys, Ron Paul, it's sort of a semi-weird suspension, because He wasn't really participating in the primary process anyway, and he's just talking about continuing his delegate selection strategy. I mean, maybe this is a little bit of a peace offering to the Romney folks, I don't know, but it's not quite the same kind of suspension that other candidates get, because he's actively saying he's going to continue. Just in his own little peculiar way. And it is all about this process of working the state process, getting into the local offices, getting these delegate positions that can vote on party issues. It's not about just becoming the nominee. Potentially about setting up Rand Paul for 2016, but it's not just about that. It's building up the strength of this sort of libertarian wing of the Republican Party. And it involves all of these local things and getting people involved in the local process and working to influence the Republican Party from within. Because obviously in the past, sort of running on libertarian principles as a third party or whatever hasn't really worked. So this is the approach they're now taking. Well, the Paul folks, the Libertarian Party is still doing its own thing. Gary Johnson will talk about that. But and the interesting thing I will note is that, you know, they're continuing the process in states long after everybody else has stopped paying attention. So, for instance, within the last 12 hours. I've gotten both a phone call and an email from folks involved with that campaign, encouraging me to actually run for local office. And you're like, oh, run for local office? Well, what are you talking about? Are you going to be on school board or something? No, no, no. There is a weird little local office called a PCO, which is a precinct committee something, something, something. It basically has no significant duties of any sort, but is involved in sort of the local party structure, will vote on local party leadership, things along those lines. And generally, there are tons of these spots that are open because nobody runs for them. And a lot of the ones where people do put in their names are unopposed because nobody bothers with this. And this is the way that Ron Paul has been racking up these little incremental wins at the local level and getting disproportionate levels of influence in the process in some of these states. Because he's basically taking his organization and getting people to actually run for some of these positions that are often unopposed. And guess what? If you run an unopposed race, generally you win. And even in the races that do have two candidates, almost nobody bothers voting for these things either because they don't know what the fuck they are. And so, even in a contested election there, you get a handful of your people to actually bother to vote, and guess what? You win again. And, like I said, these positions have little to no import in terms of actually doing anything. But they get to vote on all these sort of internal party things, which help determine the rules, which if you can determine the rules, you can help make the rules to be such that they favor your guys. And over time, that builds up. Interesting strategy. I don't know if it'll work. I also don't know, by the way, if I'm going to actually take them up on their offer. Well, it's not an offer. It's like they sent it out. I guess it is an offer. But it's not, just to be clear, it's not like some handpicked thing where they know, anything about me and are choosing me because I'm me. They're choosing me because I was on a list of people who supported Ron Paul at the earlier stage of the process. And so, I'm not sure if I'll do it or not. On the one hand, I find this kind of process stuff interesting. On the other hand, although I've been willing to call myself a Republican for purposes of like primary and caucus processes, honestly, I consider myself much more an independent, and in the past I've voted for Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, probably others at various levels of government, and basically look on a case-by-case basis and decide on what I think is best. And I don't know, it would feel weird to be sort of a little bit more committing myself to, okay, I will consider myself a Republican. Especially since, that sort of implies that you will have some degree of loyalty and support the people that party puts up. And I think, anybody who listens to this show, it's probably pretty clear, the chances of me being a Romney vote in November are pretty slim. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm an automatic Obama vote either. I'm going to give Gary Johnson a serious look. You know, but I'm certainly not going to blindly support Romney if I'm expected to do things like, you know, put up yard signs and that kind of stuff. There's no way in hell. So, you know, I'll consider it. But it would be fun, probably. But yeah, I really am not, like, thrilled with the idea of actually sort of putting my name down and saying, yeah, I'm gonna be a Republican and I'm gonna work with the Republicans. Although, you know, the fact that they're trying to change the party from within. See, there you go, the alarm just went off, but this time I realized it stopped recording. But it's probably a hint that I should move on.
This is Future Sam again. Before moving on to the topic, I just wanted to follow up. I did, in the end, decide not to put my name in for PCO. At least that's my decision as of Friday morning, and the deadline's Friday afternoon. Just too many reasons not to. I would feel disingenuous doing it. Anyway, back to the show. Okay, not back to the show quite yet, because within minutes after I sent that email, I got an email back from the Ron Paul coordinator person who I'd sent an email back saying, you know, I don't really feel comfortable. There are a couple weird issues. Like, I'm not really a Republican, and, you know, I don't feel comfortable supporting Romney. And if they're going to ask me to do get out the vote and stuff, then, But he replied back and said, basically, look, you know, a lot of people feel that way. And, you know, you should think about it in terms of, like, maybe where you can get the party to go as opposed to where it is now. And and all that you'll really have to do is go to a reorg meeting where they'll talk about the structure of the party and vote. And of course, he wants me to vote in a way that would, strengthen the non-traditional Republicans. And, you know, I'll vote my conscience. So anyway, because he replied back and said, despite all my reservations, which I'd explained to him, still think it would be a good idea, I went ahead and did it. So I filed for this with the county, which means that if I'm unopposed, which means if I filed and if I'm unopposed, then I just get the office. If anyone else files for this position, which is the Republican PCO for the Ruggs Lake precinct in Snohomish County, Washington, then I will actually be on the ballot that gets mailed out and people have to vote on. That's cool, huh? You know, so yeah, we'll see. Who knows if I'm opposed or not? Because, like, you know, at the Republican Party caucuses, only three people showed up for my precinct. Only three people showed up for my precinct at the caucuses, and so therefore all three of us became delegates because there are three delegate slots. If that's the level of participation, I might be unopposed in my precinct. But there may well be competition, in which case I'll be on the ballot and we'll see what happens. Running for elective office. Woo, Sam. Okay, anyway, now back to the show.
So in the previous version of the show, I also spent some time talking about America's Elect, and I might as well do it a little bit now, too. We had the news this morning that America's Elect had, even after delaying it, has still not found any candidates eligible under their own rules to participate in their party's online caucus primary process. Now, the way this works, for those of you who don't remember, is, you know, anybody could nominate anybody in sort of the first round, you know. So you had some people who had, you know, agreed to be candidates. You had other people who just had their names put in by random other people. But, you know, anybody could put in anybody. And the and then you would vote for your support of one of these guys. And by the way, I tried to do this, but you had to verify your registration, your voter registration, which I tried to do, and it failed. So after like the second or third try, I gave up. But anyway, in order to move to the next round, they required not just an absolute level of support, but that support be, you know, distributed across all 50 states at a certain level. Nobody reached that threshold. They gave it an extra 2 weeks. Still nobody reached that threshold. And so now they've sort of announced, well, we'll think about it and we'll come back and tell you what the next steps are, what we'll do next. But their online primary, as it was originally envisioned, is out the window because nobody qualified, because I guess interest wasn't as strong as they had hoped. Now, what does that mean? So, they're going to probably, well, look, the bottom line is they're on the ballot on all 50 states. In all 50 states. They are going to run somebody. They're not just going to run a blank line. I would be surprised if they decided to just support one of the two major party candidates. So they're going to do something.
And here's Future Sam again with two corrections, updates, whatever. First of all, America's Elect was not on the ballot on all 50 states yet, although they intended to be. They were on the ballot on 26 states so far. And second, later in the week, they announced that actually they would not run a candidate in 2012. They said they were going to stick by the rules they initially put together, and nobody qualified. Therefore, they would not be running a candidate this year. They will regroup and try again in 2016. But no candidates this year. They thanked all the volunteers for their efforts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Said, sorry, nobody qualified. We set out the rules. We debated the rules. We decided that we wanted a candidate that would gain a certain level of support, or it wasn't worth it. So nobody gained that level of support. So they determined it wasn't worth it. And that they wanted just to follow the rules and not change the rules halfway through the game. So America's Elect is not running a candidate. So the rest of my comments on America's Elect are kind of moot. So if you want to fast forward over the next couple minutes, feel free. It's already a long show, and it's going to get even longer. Sorry, I rambled. Okay, back to the show.
Now, the candidate that did have the most support on their website was former Republican governor of Louisiana, Buddy Romer. Now, you may remember, he actually did run as a Republican this time around in the early days, in 2011. But he got absolutely nowhere in the polls. He was never invited to a single one of the Republican debates. And so he saw the writing on the wall there. Well, actually, I think he stayed in as a Republican through the first few contests, but nobody paid any attention. So eventually he decided he was going to go try to win the Americans Elect nomination. He's one of the few people who's actually actively saying he wants it. But even though he was an actual governor at one point, everybody's sort of forgotten him, and he's sort of considered one of these joke candidates. Like, I'm forgetting the Democrat's name, who ran 4 years ago, former governor of Alaska or something. Had a bunch of funny campaign commercials. He's sort of treated in that same vein, as not really serious. But, you know, we'll see. They'll find somebody. The question is whether they find somebody who can actually be taken seriously, or whether they're just kind of a joke. I don't think they want to be a joke, but they're having trouble finding somebody who's ready, willing, and able to take them seriously and to do a serious job in this as their candidate, I think. Maybe it'll be Romer. I don't know. But, you know, the part I wish was the case, you know, and I've said this before, I really wish there were more, you know, I'm under no illusion that any of these third or fourth party candidates, you know, Gary Johnson on the Libertarian side, whoever Americans elect comes up with, the smattering of other sort of smaller parties, none of them are going to suddenly win the White House. It would be nice, however, to once again have a situation where one of them was getting enough support to actually get in the debates and be taken somewhat seriously and get their views aired. It was really great to have that happen in 1992 with Ross Perot. It'd be great to have it happen again here. I think there are lots of things out there where there are views that neither the Republicans nor Democrats are bringing out. Yeah, maybe Gary Johnson can do it. For, you know, he's the first governor nominated by that party. They've had some people from the House of Representatives before, of course, including Ron Paul a number of years back. But sort of the modern, recent sort of present qualifications to be a serious presidential candidate have been your former governor, former senator, or former vice president. Really, you know, that's... Now, yes, of course, there have been presidents that have not been those things. Most recently, Eisenhower, who was a general, of course. And before that, I think you have to go back to the 1800s to get somebody who was a member of the House without being anything else elected to the presidency. But so it's nice to see a governor, you know, there. But, you know, fundamentally, the kinds of things I'd like to see are somebody out there with the strong pro-civil liberties view. We talked about that issue last week on the show. But somebody out there really defending, you know, saying extrajudicial detention is flat out wrong, we won't do it. Saying extrajudicial killing, like with the drone strikes, is something we have to think about much more carefully than we have been. And I know, you know, we're at war. Well, no, actually we're not, and that's another thing. No war without declarations of war, you know, no unending war, no, you know, et cetera. In general, reduction of presidential power, although we've said before, I mean, even if you get somebody who was strongly talking about that, it's very difficult for a president actually to say, you know, I'm not going to do that, even though I could. And even if they did, even if you got a president who declined to use many of the powers accumulated by his predecessors and said often and loudly that the president doesn't have the right to do those things on his own, well, the next president would just ignore that and do them anyway because the precedent has already been set. But anyway, it'd be nice to have someone, you know, like how Ron Paul has been doing in the Republican Party, someone standing up in the debates and saying, you know, these things are wrong. We shouldn't be doing it. You know, say no to the ever-present surveillance state. Say no to all sorts of broad powers for the government to investigate its people and take unilateral action, et cetera. You know, roll back some of these things. You know, I'd also love to hear someone taking on the intellectual property lobby. Now, I'm not expecting anybody to be as extreme as my private views on this matter, which are, you know, let's abolish all forms of intellectual property entirely, and it'll bring on an amazing renaissance of innovation all across the world, despite the fact that you kill off a whole bunch of business models. I'm not expecting anybody to do that, but it would be nice and refreshing to have someone at least advocate rolling things back a little bit. You know, shorter copyright terms. More vigorous requirements to be granted a patent. Maybe a requirement, for instance, that you have to actually use it. A use it or lose it provision on patents. In general, no penalties for non-commercial infringement. Things like that. Expanded fair use. Nobody in the mainstream spectrum is advocating any of those things right now. It'd be nice to hear somebody with those views advocating them openly. There is certainly a significant minority that in the population that would agree with those things. But, you know, they've not reached the critical mass yet where any of those views are taken seriously. Similarly for, eliminating the war on drugs. Legalizing, regulating, whatever. Yeah, that's got a significantly larger minority that's in favor of that, but not yet the critical mass that, you know, a quote-unquote serious politician can openly advocate for any of those things. And, you know, we finally got, you know, the president flipping over on gay marriage. You know, maybe someday we'll have a president flipping over on the war on drugs and saying, you know, let's stop this nonsense. But, you know, we may still be a ways out. Or it may never happen. But anyway, I'm rambling. My point is simply that it would be really nice to have more voices on the stage. And it would be nice to have one that are serious. I'm not at all advocating that candidates with, like, 0.5% support should be on the debate with the two major candidates. I want a situation like in 92 where one of these third parties gets enough traction so that they're polling, you know, at 10, 15, 20%, at which point they deserve to be in the debates and they deserve to be heard. I don't know whether or not I'd vote for them, but it would be nice to hear the alternative views. Anyway, I arrived at the building I need to be at a few minutes ago. I need to go in and prepare for my meeting. Hell yeah, and maybe get some breakfast. So I will say goodbye for now. There's going to be another break, and then I'll come back. So enjoy your break, and we'll talk to you on the other side about something else. And I promise this time, I hope it won't be about the election stuff. I will come up with something else exciting to talk about. You know, maybe Europe is imploding economically with Greece. There's the whole J.P. Morgan fiasco that happened. There's always Apple rumors. I don't know. I'll be back after this message. Enjoy your break.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And we're back. It is now Wednesday, the 16th, and I am on my way home from work yet again. Yay! Long day, not very productive day. I did my thing that I was there early for, that went well, and then I was kind of exhausted and tired and did a few things here and there, but it was a long day. Anyway, we're back. What else is there to talk to on this fourth and final segment for the last Curmudgeon's Corner, not the last Curmudgeon's Corner, the last segment of Curmudgeon's Corner for today? And I will, like, put in my usual apology when I do these car shows. Every time when I do these car shows, when I'm putting together a show later, I'm like, this sounds like crap. And I'm sorry. And I apologize. And I should just suck it up and record these shows at home or record them at the time I normally would have recorded. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hello, testing 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I got a phone call that interrupted me. And so sorry about that. I was busy apologizing about how the audio quality sucked. And of course, while I got the phone call, I realized, hey, I could probably improve it a little bit by, instead of just having my phone and my mount in my car and talking, plugging in my headset and speaking into the microphone on the headset. The little iPhone headset, not the kind you wear on your head that sticks out in front of you and stuff. So hopefully this sounds a little bit better. But again, I apologize, the show sucks. The show audio quality anyway, and probably the show too, I don't know. Anyway, for the last topic. No president stuff, I promised. No president stuff. As tempting as it is, no president stuff. Maybe a little bit about JP Morgan, or Greece imploding, or leaving the euro, or whatever. But, you know, I think Greece, I'll leave that to Yvonne. We'll talk about that next week. He'll undoubtedly have a lot more to say about that than I do, and more well-researched and read on the topic. The same is probably true of JP Morgan, but I'm going to talk about it anyway.
This is Future Sam for hopefully the last time this show. Right after this point, I kind of went off the rails. I was tired. I didn't know what else to say. I didn't realize that I'd already recorded an hour and 10 minutes of show. Well, a little less than that, and then an hour and 10 minutes once you add the Future Sam bits. Or I would have just wrapped it up. But I thought I had a fourth segment that I needed to do. So I did a fourth segment. But I didn't really have anything planned out. And I just sort of, well, you know, I was already rambling in this show. And I rambled even more. And I started spitting out a whole bunch of ideas and thoughts about things that, you know, in retrospect, if I look at it carefully, I probably don't even agree with myself. I might agree with myself. But these are clearly issues where I haven't thought it through. And not at all. And I could be advocating, the things I'm advocating in some cases are probably just flat out batshit insane stupid. Okay? So consider the next segment as a thought experiment, and only a thought experiment. Don't consider any of these things to be things that I'm actually advocating. I was just rambling and letting my mind go where it went. And if you're already sick of this after almost an hour and 15 minutes, you don't have to listen to the next 15. You can just skip to the next show. It's okay. You're not missing anything too horribly exciting. Entertaining, maybe. I don't know. You can listen to Sam as he sort of dives off the deep end into a bunch of nonsense. You know, and I talk about all kinds of like crazy regulations that could be done and all kinds of state government interference into private corporations that I don't think I really agree with, but I don't know, you know, anyway, but you listen to it for what it is. If you listen at all, if anybody's left at this point, I'm probably just talking to myself. I often talk to myself. Talking to myself is enjoyable, but I will stop talking to myself now as Super Sam and let you go back to listening to me talk to myself back on Wednesday when I recorded this. So enjoy the rest of the show, I guess. Yeah, enjoy it. It's probably entertaining. I don't know. I got to finish up the show and get to work. Anyway, it's blah, blah, blah. Listen to the show. Enjoy. Bye.
But specifically, not so much about, you know, okay, some guy at JP Morgan made a stupid decision and, you know, ended up taking a gamble that cost a lot of money. A couple billion, was it? A couple billion? I forget exactly, but anyway, and, you know, some people have left the company, but the CEO is still there, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the relevant point, I think, that comes out of this is that this is a company that it brings up all the questions of regulation. And when is it appropriate to regulate large companies, large banks, large financial institutions, etc.? And I'm going to speak more generally, not specifically about the J.P. Morgan case, but just more generally about the larger question. Because, you know, back in, you know, 2008, 2009, we had the major financial crisis. We had to bail out a whole bunch of companies. The notion was that if we didn't, the entire economy would implode. And it was because of, you know, in that case, it was the housing market. In this case, it might be something different. But regardless, all kinds of things had been structured essentially as a house of cards, where there is gamble on top of gamble on top of gamble. And when they start not going the way people had predicted they were going, everything falls apart. And so there are a couple questions here. One, specifically with banks, where you've got federal insurance of deposits, it seems like there's a fairly strong case to be made that, you know, as long as that federal deposit insurance exists, it's reasonable for there to be conditions on how the money is used. Now, I've said time and time again, I'm not a huge, huge fan of regulation. In many cases, I'm in favor of the free market running its course, blah, 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 and people just having recourse through, you know, contracts and, you know, laws against fraud, etc. But a lot of that tends to not necessarily be that effective, actually, in these situations. And yes, the people running rampant leads to all kinds of amazing profits while it's going on. But in the end, it's highly risky. And, you know, you are potentially putting those deposits at risk and putting the federal government in a position that it might have to back some of those deposits. I think some of the calls to go back to rules that clearly separated, you know, traditional old-fashioned boring banking from, you know, the world of high finance and investing and, you know, the old-fashioned investment banks versus regular banks split that was gotten rid of sometime in the Clinton administration. Glass-Steagall, I believe, was the relevant law. I think it's perfectly reasonable to put those kinds of restrictions back, to be honest. Would it result in, you know, the big investment companies and banks making less money? Yeah, probably. I don't see a problem with that. If the money that's being, you know, if the money that's being made is made on speculation rather than actually adding value to the economy and the country by actually, you know, making something or providing some service, you know, I don't feel bad about constraining that. I think, you know, you want to direct economic activity towards stuff that's actually productive. I know, here I am talking like, you know, I'm all in favor of, you know, a sort of government, you know, direction of the economy. It's not really quite that. However, you know, I do see, it's not an absolute if or to me. Like, you know, yes, I'm in favor of less government intervention, but I'm not an absolutist. I'm not in favor of, you know, free for all, let everybody do everything all the time. In a lot of areas, yes. But in certain areas, I can definitely see the argument here. But also more to the point, and I think that there are a couple more factors here. One, you know, restricting what the businesses can or can't do and the details of how they do it, you know, I'd actually rather not go there. I think that's getting too detailed. Like, one of the things that has been brought up in regard to this debate, but in terms of others in general, is that it's really, I think, you know, Matt Iglesias said something related to this in the last week, and I know others have as well, but you know, it's really simple. Like, if you provide a general guideline, you can say a guideline in a couple sentences about, you know, you don't want banks to trade their own books, or you want banks' primary business to be you know, to support the depositors or something like that. But it's very hard to translate that into actual real-life rules that are followed in detail. And when you do that, the rules get complicated. The industries being regulated lobby for specific rules. They work on, you know, getting in all the right loopholes and making things so complicated to follow that, first of all, only the big players can hope to even jump through all the hoops. So you start, you know, raising the barriers of entry to new people in that market, which helps the incumbents and reduces the overall efficiency of the market in that area. But also, you know, these companies get to be absolute experts at figuring out how to get around the specific rules and still do what they want to anyway, but in a much less transparent fashion. So, like, I'm not in favor of super, super detailed rules that outline all of the, you know, all of the possible permutations. It's much better, I think, to have as simple a rule as you can possibly come up with. And I know that's where the trick comes in. How can you really do it? Like, for instance, people have talked about too big to fail. Well, what does that really mean? Well, you could just set a maximum size for a company. You know, you have more than a certain number of employees or more than a certain amount of revenue or more than a certain amount of market cap, and you're required to split into two roughly equal pieces within a certain amount of time. You know, but there are all kinds of details there and blah, blah, blah. But I still think that we, you know, it would be very healthy if we could get to a point where what is passed into law would articulate the general principle that is supposed to be being enforced or the goal, and then, yeah, set up a regulatory body with authority to, you know, make regulations to meet that goal. Have that reviewed periodically to see if it's meeting the goal. Like, and the regulations get tossed out if it's shown to not be meeting that goal. I don't know. The problem with all of this kind of stuff is it's a lot easier to say something like that than to actually implement it, because the devil is in the details, and the details matter, and it's like, and it does get complicated. But I don't know. I think the maze of regulations we have now is, I think, probably counterproductive. It's probably not making anything any better. When there's proposals right now going on for the Volcker rule. But from everything I understand, that's getting more and more, as the lobbyist gets their hands on it, and as the various compromises are made that are needed to for anything like that, of having a hope of passing, it's getting so watered down and so many loopholes and conditions and blah, blah, blah added that it's not going to make that much of a difference, probably. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. And that's the problem, of course, is to get these things passed in the first place, you often have to make them so that they have no teeth. But a lot of the things that, you know, as far as I can tell, nobody has learned anything whatsoever from the big collapse in 2008 and 2009. Everybody's up to their same old tricks again. They're just as willing to gamble as they were before. Those who were worried about the bailouts resulting in moral hazard, where, you know, oh, we don't have to worry about anything because if anything really bad happens, you know, they'll bail us out. Plus, nobody's going to jail or anything, and we'll keep all our money. You know. Now, you know, I remember at the time, back when the big crisis was going on, saying, you know, I know everybody's predicting complete financial implosion if they just let all of them fail, but I almost want all of them to just fail and let the financial implosion happen, because essentially by not letting that happen, and not following up with any significant changes. I mean, you know, with the bailouts, for the most part, we didn't even require a change in management. Yeah, it seems to me like that should have been the bare minimum. You know, anybody who was involved in these decisions, you're out of here. You know, but none of that. Nobody went to jail. Yeah, nobody. Very few people got fired. And so you get all the same things again, and you know. Next time it happens, maybe it'll be worse. At some point, you have to unwind all this stuff, and then you know make it so that you know people don't do it again. And this is the pattern that happens with these things. Like you know, I mentioned Glass-Steagall before. That was a reaction to you know the series of catastrophic bank failures and such that happened in the lead up to the Great Depression. And, you know, the banking industry was very different and much more boring and much less profitable after that, but it was stable. And then, you know, the people who had vivid memories of those events slowly but surely died off, got out of politics, retired. And then everybody's like, hey, what do we have all these regulations for? They're just getting in the way. Let's get rid of them. And boom, you take them out, and boom, the same kind of mistakes start happening again. Because, you know, those were put there for a reason. You know, people learned lessons and said, you know, people can't be trusted to be smart about this kind of thing. Because it's human nature to take excessive risks, especially when there's lots of money involved. And, oh, well. I don't know. I think the answer to these kinds of things isn't clear to me. But what is clear is that we have created an environment where there's still no downside to taking lots of risk. Or no significant downside. Let's put it that way. There's always a downside. You lose the money or whatever. But there's not enough there to incent people out of it. And I think there are lots of these areas where, you know, it would be good. We would have a healthier overall economy if we didn't allow some of these things to happen. It might not be exciting. We'd be, you know, cutting the peaks off some of the big growth periods. But hopefully that would be balanced by making the down cycles a little bit less bad. And certainly on the good, too big to fail side of things, I think that's still a very valuable concept, and nobody's done anything about it per se. You know, again, there was a lot of talk about it while everything was imploding a few years ago, and then afterwards, nothing. And you know. The suggestion I made sort of tongue-in-cheek a few minutes ago, I could deal with something that said, you know, we're going to cap the maximum size of a company. Sorry, if it gets bigger than this, it gets broken up. And the subsidiary companies can do whatever they want, but once you hit that maximum size, split. It would enhance competition. It would make us less vulnerable to too big to fail situations across any number of industries. I'm not just talking banks. But I realize it sounds draconian, and at the same time, it goes completely against my instincts to keep government out of it. But I think, really, my problem with government is not government. My problem with government is concentration of power and concentration of influence. And I'm all about decentralization. And yes, I know economies of scale can get you a lot of cool things. But I think whenever you get too much power and influence concentrated in one place, it's a bad thing. And it doesn't matter if it's government or a corporation or a nonprofit entity, like, you know, or a religious group or whatever. It's dangerous when that gets concentrated in one place. So I think I could deal with the situation where there was an automatic assumption that when you grow beyond a certain size, you split. You know, and either you do it yourself, you know, in a nice orderly fashion, or if, you know, you get to a certain size and you haven't done it already, then regulators come in and do it for you. I don't know. I know that's draconian, and I know it'll never, ever happen. And like I say, I struggle with the fact that in order to implement that, you would need massive government regulation and involvement in order to do that. And I struggle with that, but I think it might still be an okay idea. And I'm not saying, like, the maximum size should be, like, 20 people or anything. I mean, you can have some pretty damn big companies, but beyond a certain point, you know, I think it's okay to take the big company and split it up. And not just in a monopoly situation. Although, certainly, if a monopoly develops, you'd certainly be triggering what I'm talking about. But, like, I don't think it has to be that far gone. Anyway, I'm repeating myself and have nothing else to say. So let's wrap up the show. This has been Curmudgeon's Corner for, you know, I will date the show from when I started the show, because that's what I always do. But what has it been? The 13th, 14th, and 15th? 14th, 15th, and 16th? I don't know. It's been Curmudgeon's Corner for this week. Hopefully Yvonne will be back with us next week. As usual, email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com with any questions, comments, thoughts, anything else. Tell your friends, tweet us, Facebook us. I've been saying that for a couple weeks, but nobody's done it. At least that I've seen. Come on, tell your friends. Well, okay, maybe not this show. Wait till Yvonne's back. Anyway, thanks for listening. Tune in next week. Goodbye.